Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio today are Laura Noonan, our investment banking correspondent, Caroline Binham, our financial regulation correspondent, and Emma Dunkley, our retail banking correspondent. Down the line, we have Don Wineland, our Asia financial correspondent. This week, we'll be talking about Deutsche Bank as it breaks the Volcker rule, a look at Credit Suisse and other European banks as they report first quarter earnings following a bumper season in the US. Thirdly, a look at UK Finance, the new banking lobby group in the UK. And finally, a quick view from Asia from Don Wineland as UnionPay, the Chinese credit card, tries to break free of its domestic borders. First, though, that story about Deutsche Bank. Caroline, I don't think any other bank has yet fallen foul of the Volcker rule, which is this anti-proprietary trading rule that was introduced in the US post-crisis to stop banks betting their own money. But Deutsche Bank has been fined because of it.
Yeah, that's right. Deutsche Bank was fined last week by the Fed, $157 million. And I think in the pantheon of Deutsche Bank fines, that's not particularly noteworthy. But what was interesting was that this was the first penalty that we've seen for alleged violations of the Volcker rule, which, as you said, was introduced in the wake of the crisis and essentially bans big banks from prop trading. So what the Fed said was that there were shoddy controls at Deutsche over whether traders were performing the right checks on whether trades were on behalf of clients or, in fact, betting with the bank's own money, which is really at the heart of the Volcker rule. And I guess the other interesting point about this is that it comes at a point when the Volcker rule, which is part of the Dodd-Frank reforms, are in the sights of Donald Trump and the new administration. He's already pledged to roll back some of Dodd-Frank and, in fact, last week also signed an executive order, which was the first step really to perhaps overhauling parts of Dodd-Frank, including this fund that is set up to handle too-big-to-fail banks. It's called Title II, and it's this emergency liquidity assistance fund, essentially. So I guess, yes, the first Volcker violation penalty, but question whether it'd also be the last.
Yeah, of course, we heard last week from Paul Volcker, who talked to me about his outlook on deregulation and what he saw as the future for the Volcker rule. You can listen back to that through ft.com/banking. But yeah, Caroline, it's a really interesting precedent. I suppose it tells a broader tale about Deutsche's controls and certainly illustrates a broader point that a lot of banks complain about the administrative burden of this whole rule.
That's certainly true. I mean, the plans to reform Dodd-Frank and certainly Volcker have met very little resistance on Wall Street just because, as you say, they complain that the rule is too onerous and it just doesn't really make much sense. It's hard to really draw a red line between what's on behalf of the bank and what's on behalf of a client. I think it's also true, as you say, that this is the most recent in a long line of Deutsche penalties. But just to put it in context, the big fine that happened at the tail end of last year over mis-selling of mortgage-backed securities was $7.2 billion.
Yes, in the olden days, a 100-and-something fine, as this one was, would be a big fine, not anymore. Laurie, you wanted to come in.
I mean, just on that point, it's hard to imagine any bank would intentionally breach the Volcker rule. But the issue is whether you can easily unintentionally do it. Because as you say, Deutsche has such a checkered legal history, particularly in the US. It would in no way make sense for them to intentionally defy this rule and to go and bet with their own cash. And the other thing that we learned over the financial crisis is that a lot of banks, when they did trade on their own behalf, they weren't terribly good at it. They made very big losses. And actually, many banks say even if they were enabled to actually trade on their own behalf again, they would do so very cautiously. And there are a number of banks who, while they would like the admin burden of the Volcker rule to be taken back, they're not actually overly keen on the idea of getting into these very big bets with their own balance sheet again.
Very good. Well, there's a neat segue there, Laura, to your second item, which is a look at European bank earnings. Of course, Deutsche is one of them that's coming up over the coming days. But I wanted to ask you first about Credit Suisse in particular. They've been in the news partly over a pay row with their shareholders. There's an AGM coming up where we'll get a vote on senior pay at the end of the week. Before that, though, they have their first quarter earnings, where we may learn a bit more about their capital plans, or maybe not. But what are you hearing?
I mean, Credit Suisse is an interesting one to start off the European investment bank's earnings season, purely because for the last few quarters, it's all been about the big picture and not about the actual numbers. The same is once again true in this quarter. The big things people are talking about, first of all, the update around the bank's capital. So the bank has acknowledged it has a capital shortfall, probably somewhere between $2 to $4 billion. The question is whether they're going to fill it by either listing the Swiss unit, which they had initially planned on doing, or whether they're going to actually go to the shareholders and ask for more capital, or if they're going to hope that earnings can ultimately fill the gap. Now, some analysts expect to get an update on that at the results this week. It's kind of uncertain because, as you say, the bank does have its AGM at the end of the week, this Friday. The bank hasn't put forward a proposal to ask shareholders for permission to raise money. And if they were going to raise any kind of significant fund, they would need to ask shareholders. So it seems unlikely that they're going to announce a large capital raise. Then, as you point out, they're also facing a lot of resistance around pay. Credit Suisse has already said it's going to cut bonuses and pay for executives by 40%, that it would be very difficult to go in and get shareholders to approve what is still seen as a pretty generous package for executives on the one hand, and say, and we would also like some more of your cash to fill a capital hole. Beyond that, Credit Suisse has still got some pretty big litigation issues hanging over it. The most recent was the subject of raids on its private bank in five countries a few weeks back. People will be expecting an update on that. But then there's also the hard figures. While they aren't as important as these big picture capital existential questions, they will still be interesting. Unusually for Credit Suisse, they're expected to probably have the best performing global markets business in Europe. And that's based on a year-on-year comparison. I wouldn't get too excited by that because it was absolutely horrible last year. Last year was a year when we had the $1 billion or so loss on a distressed debt portfolio and other parts of the investment bank, which triggered a kind of public blame game between the CEO and the markets business. They aren't going to have that this year. They will also benefit from the Fairwind, which has helped the US investment banks post a largely good first quarter. So we are expecting some bright spot from Credit Suisse on that front.
And in 10 seconds, Deutsche Bank?
Deutsche Bank would be interesting because we'll see if the franchise damage that we saw in the fourth quarter of last year has held up, or if they've managed to regain some in the first quarter. And that'll be really in the investment bank, and that's really the thing to watch there. Also, we always remain interested in the capital level. I mean, Deutsche Bank's obviously done a lot of work on capital, but I think people will be looking at that number again.
Okay. We have two mini segments to finish off this week's podcast. Firstly, to Emma, I wanted to ask you about the creation of a UK bank lobby group. This is an organisation called UK Finance, and it also has a new chief.
So UK Finance is essentially an amalgamation of about six bank-related bodies spanning mortgages, card payments, asset management to an extent. And it's recently appointed Stephen Jones as its head, and it will be launching within the next few weeks. Now, Stephen Jones is formerly an advisor to Cerberus, the US private equity firm, and has gained extensive experience within the UK banking sector, formerly working at Santander UK and Barclays. And the idea behind this new group is that it provides a bigger, more forceful lobbying organisation at a time that's quite crucial, really, with Brexit negotiations coming up, and also following the reputational damage that's been done to the banking sector to a degree, following the global financial crisis and a string of mis-selling scandals over the past few years. Mr. Jones has also said that he will be looking to unite banking voices in order to counter criticism against the raft of branch closures that have happened over the past few years, and also the lack of competition in SME banking. But I guess one negative to this new group, and some quarters have expressed concern, is that some of the old groups might not have their voice heard and have very different interests to promote. For example, you have the Council of Mortgage Lenders and you also have the UK Cards Association that are part of this merger, and they both have very different needs.
Okay, and as you say, notable that probably for brand reasons, the word bank is not in the title of the new group. It's called UK Finance, and it replaces, as you say, the CML, UK Cards Association, but mainly the British Bankers Association, which was the biggest dominant group until now. Thanks very much for that, Emma. Now, let's go to Don Wineland. Don, thanks for joining us. This is a really interesting story about the biggest Chinese credit card operation attempting to go global and challenge Visa and MasterCard, or at least starting to do that. Tell us exactly what's been going on.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Patrick. So it's not only the biggest Chinese credit card payment processing company. It's really the only one. It's a state-backed company called UnionPay. They have had a near complete monopoly on the market in China since they launched in 2002. And UnionPay and Visa and MasterCard, you know, the global card companies have gotten into this huge WTO dispute over the opening of the Chinese market. And the Chinese market is supposed to actually open this year. So you should see Visa and MasterCard beginning to set up their own local currency payment processing or payment clearing operations in China. Visa and MasterCard have been trying to do that for a decade. What UnionPay is doing is UnionPay has, as I said, really a total monopoly on the domestic market. Over the past couple of years, they've been expanding overseas. And originally, they were chasing after Chinese tourists as they went overseas. So they rolled out merchant capabilities globally. I mean, I think their cards are accepted in 160-something countries globally. So that was the first process. But what they've been doing more recently is they've been partnering with banks in countries around the world. I think there's about 40 different countries that they've issued local cards. So you have local banks issuing UnionPay cards. And at this point, it's somewhat unclear who is picking up these cards. You know, are they local Chinese merchants that live abroad that might travel to China? I think in certain markets like in Myanmar or in Democratic Republic of Congo, you actually have a lot of local people that don't really have any connection to China that are picking up a UnionPay card as opposed to a Visa and a MasterCard as the first credit card that they receive when they begin taking part in this part of the financial market.
Well, it's a really interesting forerunner potentially of what the market might look like more broadly with a third challenger to Visa and MasterCard in the global market. Don, thanks very much for that swift introduction to UnionPay and its global expansion. Well, that's it for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank Laura, Emma and Caroline here in the studio and Don Wineland, our Asia financial correspondent down the line. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Fiona Simon. Until next week, goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.